Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
My guest today is Dr. David Bentley Hart, an Eastern Orthodox theologian and popular author who frequently writes for journals such as First Things, as well as publishing numerous books including The Experience of God, The Devil and Pierre Janet, and the book we will be taking on most directly today, Atheist Delusions, The Christian Revolution and Its Fashionable Enemies. This latter book was awarded the Michael Ramsey Prize for Theological Writing in 2011, a very distinguished honor. As always, we will have links to this book, a few additional ones written by Professor Hart, and some interesting tidbits, including related podcasts, all located at our site, Research on Religion. So please drop by and visit. David, welcome to Research on Religion.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah, hi. Thank you.
You are a very accomplished and prolific author, having written about 9 books and an uncountable number of articles. I want to spend time today, though, focusing on the work that earned you the Michael Ramsey Prize, Atheist Delusions. This was a full frontal assault on what has been called the New Atheist Movement, and that has been associated with the likes of Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, Sam Harris, as well as a few lesser-known folks like Daniel Dennett. My first question for you is, what possessed you to write that book?
Well, to be honest, it was the book that was proposed to me by an acquisitions editor at a press that ultimately wasn't a press that published it anyway. So I can't claim that it was an inspiration of my own. Forgive me, this would be somewhat churlish of me. I actually don't think of it as a full frontal assault on the New Atheists. So it was actually only accidentally that it came to be seen that way, I think, mostly because the title Atheist Delusions was added by editors of my press. It does take them on, but really uses them more as a framing device for a larger argument.
Just a little inside baseball talk here on the publishing world. That's very interesting that somebody came to you and said, we have this idea for a book, would you like to write it? And then the publishing house that suggested that to you didn't publish it. You went somewhere else. How did that all occur?
Well, it was simply that I wanted to write the book somewhat differently. The original house was Random House, and they would want it somewhat more popularly written book, and I didn't care to write it that way. I wanted it to be pitched more to an audience, not specialist, not expert in the field, but a literate audience that would have some patience for historical detail and the occasional philosophical detours. So my agent found Yale or Oxford would be a better place to put it, and we ended up with Yale.
Oh, okay. And was this a labor of love for you that flowed from your earlier works, or because this was suggested to you, was this a book born more of frustration and, you know, I have to write this and I have to deal with these Christopher Hitchens types that are out there?
Well, as I say, it was born out of a proposal made by a third party, to be honest. It wasn't a labor of love, no, because, to be honest, it was difficult to write since I was more or less covering material that I already knew well and was, in a sense, entering an argument that didn't interest me at the time. In fact, it was somewhat accident. It was something of an accident that it came to be associated with the New Atheist Movement. It was really because as I was writing it, the New Atheists had just enjoyed their Annus Mirabilis, which was 2006, and they became a convenient framing device. But at first, I think I was I was a little bit naive about the degree to which they would be taken seriously. The books were, not to put too fine a point on it, the books were all very poor, and being something perhaps of a recluse from popular debates, I wasn't aware that anyone or many people would take the books very seriously. So that was actually more of a marginal concern for me. I wasn't deeply moved by any need to respond to them. I was more concerned just basically by historical misconceptions that are common when people try to understand the history and the nature of early Christianity, why it triumphed. Misconceptions in some cases go back as far as the 18th century. And if you look in the center of the book, I'm often dealing with historians who in the academic world would be considered prominent, who are names, but aren't necessarily well-known beyond academic circles.
That is true, and we're going to get to some of those names here as we go through here. But you do frame the book, as you said. I think the term framing there is important. Early in the first pages, the first chapter, talking about the likes of Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens, and you bring a few of those folks to the bear. Was this intentional, or was this something that your publisher decided to tell you to do to frame it a little bit better?
I never listened to publishers.
Okay.
No. As I say, I was writing it at a time when those books had all reached the bestseller list, and I realized that the book I was writing was germane to a debate that had suddenly broken into public consciousness, and it just seemed convenient. For one thing, I didn't have to construct straw men.
They were there.
They were there.
Yeah.
And if I had gone out of my way, if I had actually conscripted people or entered into a conspiracy to get people to write very bad books, advancing a sort of new popular atheism, so that I could then ridicule it. I'm sorry to say, there's a touch of that in the book. I couldn't have done better than Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens and Daniel Dennett. Those were the four big names at the time. And there are some others that are around the edges who also rode the wave.
Now, you do use the term ridicule right there, and that's what gives me the reason to say full frontal assault on the New Atheist movement, because as I read through the book, it you engaged these authors square on to begin with, and then move on to wipe away some of the other misconceptions that are not only held by these gentlemen, but by a number of other academic scholars dating back to Edward Gibbon, that you really... I mean, you do a good job of leveling a lot of these arguments. So that's where I'm coming with the full frontal assault.
No, I understand. In terms of tone, it's correct. But it's funny, when I think of the book, there are four sections in the book, the two flanking sections, the beginning and end, which are very short, are the only ones that really address the new atheist. The central argument, I think, is more substantial than I could have made if I were just engaging with them, because the arguments they don't have much substance to begin with, and so there's not much to grab hold of there. I have to admit, I used them as occasions at times for some comic relief. Again, not always necessarily the most charitable way to proceed.
Well, it is a book that is actually very fun to read, and I can just see you having fun writing the book. And this is a book that was suggested to you, and were you surprised at all by the success of the book? I mean, this is something that, I have a lot of other things to do. Should I be doing this? You go ahead and write it, then, and all of a sudden you win the Michael Ramsey Prize for Theological Writing, which comes with a nice sizable chunk of cash.
Well, it's not the Nobel Prize.
No, it's not, but, it's a prize.
I'm not buying any villas with it. But, it's a prize that I was very honored to receive. The Archbishop of Canterbury at the time was still Rowan Williams, and and he was one of the judges, and I like to think that his judgment leaned towards my book as well. I figure I greatly respect. And there were others, like Janet Soskis, who were on the panel, whom I also have great esteem, so it was a meaningful award to me. And yeah, I was surprised, to be honest. Surprised that the book was read more widely than, and continues to be apparently, than I anticipated.
And I have one more question just related to this stream of thought here on how the book got published and came into being is, why did the publisher, the initial publisher, not the publisher you ended up with, come to you specifically to write this? Was there a certain reason for why that was the case?
I don't know, to be honest. It was just an acquisitions editor who had obviously read enough things by me in the past that he liked my style or my perspective or both, and very likable guy. He would have gladly gone ahead with the book himself, but again, the kind of book I wanted to write wouldn't really be a random house book. But beyond that, I had no insight. He just apparently saw something he thought was worth acquiring.
Very cool. If there's any publishers out there that need me to write some stuff and award-winning books or something, you can contact me at the website there. So I'll leave that open for them. Let's go ahead and dive into the book now. And before we get to the center parts of the book where you take on a number of the claims by atheists, either the new atheist or the old atheist, and level those claims, I want to talk about the two flanking sections of the book, and that's the new atheist. And I have to admit here that not only were you requested to write that book, but we've had a number of our listeners actually request to have you on the show. So they wanted to hear you speak about these new atheist folks and why they are fashionable enemies. So give us a bit of background for those of us who are not all that familiar with this group of folks. How has the new atheist movement emerged over time? And what is the difference between new atheist and old atheist? And I guess the other question there is, why are they fashionable, as it says in the subtitle of your book?
Well, I'll start with the last issue. They're fashionable because that's all they are. That's why I call them that. The truth is that they do represent a current fashion. And I think it is, as articulations of atheism go, far less impressive, far shallower, far more intellectually uncommanding than serious attempts to give shape to an atheist vision of reality were in previous generations. So I think also that, like all fashions, it will have its moment and pass. I tend to think these things go in cycles. But I also think that they're fashionable in another sense, in that they represent, and this is one of the ways in which the new atheists really do differ from atheists of old. They are men, and I suppose some women, but all the ones that we hear about are men, who are probably the first generation of committed and voluble atheists who really don't know anything about what they're attacking. They don't come from backgrounds of faith. They weren't raised in an atmosphere of belief. They don't have a sort of tacit sense of or an immediate intuitive understanding of the culture of previous generations that produced atheists. I mean, well, take Nietzsche was the son of a pastor, for instance. Even as outlandish or outrageous as his remarks about Christianity may seem to Christians, they actually strike at weak points, at least in Christian psychology, because they arise from an intimate awareness of at least certain kinds of Christianity. And he was an historian and classicist, and he knew things about the rise of Christianity. He could place it within the context of ancient culture. Or even take someone like H.L. Mencken, someone I love. I'm a Marylander, and we all revere Mencken. He was a person who was always on good terms with let's say, the Catholic clergy in Baltimore, because when he argued points of faith, or belief and unbelief, he had some understanding of these things. He knew something of German Catholic culture and Christian culture, and he was, you know, he had grown up within a culture that as a whole, that still had some sense of the grammar of Christian faith. When you turn to people like Dawkins and Dennett and Hitchens, you're really on new ground, especially Sam Harris. I mean, Sam Harris is very young, very callow, and deeply uneducated. And the result is peculiar. It's an atheism that's a rejection. It's, on the one hand, it's the embrace of who knows what, a kind of fantasy form of materialism, a kind of entirely quixotic enlightenment faith that seems completely unacquainted with modern history as well. But it's also a rejection of something very close to a fantasy monster, some sort of creature summoned up out of vague apprehensions, and old rumors, and urban mythology. It's the first generation of atheists, I think, who genuinely, authentically emerge from a post-Christian world. And I find this a comforting thought, because I like to think that what's vapid in their work is a reflection of what's vapid in a post-Christian culture.
I want to probe that term that you used there for a minute, post-Christian world, because one of the other questions I wanted to ask about this cohort of new atheists was, why did they appear at this period of time? They've been active in, say, the first decade of the 2000s, and we don't hear as much about them as recently, but, you know, 5-6 years ago, they were all the rage. And you use this term that they're emerging in a post-Christian world. Are we in that world, and what does that mean now? And when did this post-Christian world become a post-Christian world?
Well, actually, now you are touching on the central issues of the book. When I say post-Christian world, I mean the world of Western modernity. I don't mean it more globally than that. Some parts of the world are entering into what is beginning to look more and more like a new Christendom, or a new paradigm of Christendom. Not Christendom in the sense of throne and altar, but new Christian culture taking shape in places like sub-Saharan Africa and parts of Latin America and East Asia. So I mean that specifically in terms of late modernity. And that is a long story. That's something that really can be traced back, in a sense, to the very threshold of modernity, in which requires a much more patient archaeology and genealogy necessarily than I give it in the book. I touch upon certain movements of modernity. One, just the emergence of the nation state, of a kind of national sovereignty, first vested in a monarch attached to the notion of divine right, but a sovereignty that's somehow prior to or more original than the larger claims of the mystical body of the church, and the rise of mercantile capitalism, which I think, no matter what your politics, you have to acknowledge that late modernity, the full commercial phase of capitalist culture, is one that is far removed from a Christian vision of reality. It has a separate set of values, and Christianity's values are antagonistic to many of them. And so on and so forth. I mean, that's a discussion we could have for hours on end, and I doubt your podcast goes that long. But I think you do have to say, yeah, we're in a post-Christian world in this sense, that the grammar, the values, the presuppositions, the sort of bread and the bone sensitivity to the Christian way of seeing things, that however defectively was part of the cultural context we all lived in, you know, has over the past few generations disappeared. And even in a country like America, where you have a very high rate of persons who profess formally a Christian faith, if you examine the cultural presuppositions with which they live, many of them are also, in that sense, post-Christian. There are all sorts of mixed loyalties. And I'm afraid I can't be more specific than that within the constraints of the time we have.
Oh, that's fine. We'll dig into some of this transition between what is known as the Age of Faith and the Age of Reason, and we'll probably touch upon that as we go along. But sticking with this group of new atheists, the Dawkins, the Dennetts, the Harrises, the Hitchens, the process you just described was a much more generational issue, as you noted. But again, these folks appeared, they hit the scene pretty big in the past, 10, 15 years or so. And it's interesting, people like Dawkins, who is, he's in evolutionary biology, he's crafted a fairly big career for himself there, but all of a sudden he really gets into spouting about religion all of a sudden. And, Hitchens follows closely on his heels, and so do some of these other folks like Sam Harris. Is there something unique about the past 10 or 15 years that has provided the fertilizer for these seeds to grow?
Well, I think after the attack, 2001, that it became emotionally respectable, let's say, for a lot of people to become more aggressively anti-religious. And a lot of the anti-religiousness of the early part of this past decade, from 2000 to 2010, was really anti-Islamic, under the umbrella of a larger attack on all religion that then became united with also the sort of resentments, the often quite callow resentments, but also legitimate resentments that people feel towards the reigning religious culture that they grow up in. So anti-Muslim sentiment, anti-Christian sentiment came together at a crucial moment when it was more respectable because of the violence of those attacks. Now, that comes, of course, at the price of a huge refusal of any subtlety, because whenever something like that happens, you have to ask all sorts of questions, not only the distinctions between religions and cultures, but the attempt to discern within what's a putatively religious, let's say, atrocity, what is really religious, what is really of the tradition, what isn't, what it has, what actually serves other interests, political, social, economic, so on. But as a purely superficial judgment on the time, there was just a moment of emotional liberation, I think, for a lot of persons who dislike religion viscerally, when they felt they could say this because there was this horrible event giving them impetus. I other than that, though, I don't know if you can say why now, because as I say, I do believe these things come in cycles. The anti-religious temper of the academy, for instance, in some sense was probably greater at the beginning of the 20th century than it is now, curiously enough. Or if we were to go back to the late 19th century and see the sort of people with whom William James was in argument, so for the rationality of mystical knowledge, say, or of religious belief, you find that he was already dealing with the same sorts of arguments. The difference now is that is just the lack of substance in the way it's articulated. There, I think, is the unique inflection of the early 21st century in these arguments. So much of it is basically at the level of chatter and gossip and journalism rather than deep study or deep thinking. And I think that's something about our culture. We are devolving into a culture of continuous chatter. Right? Maybe it has something to do with the Internet, I don't know. I'll be the Luddite here. It seems to be our technological destiny. But whatever the case, I do think that moment will continue. past. I think it'll subside. We'll probably, in a couple decades, have another period of where New Age thinking is on the rise again. This all ebbs and flows.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that I have noticed throughout history when people talk about the decline of Christianity and the rise of atheism. You can go back and in almost any other decade and find evidence to support those claims, even dating back to the 1600s and 1700s.
Well, I will say this, though. When I say ebb and flow, I'm talking about what's culturally fashionable. Mm-hmm. I do think that the history of Christianity in the West is one that has reached a certain terminus from which you can't turn back. I will say that. I mean, there's not going to be a huge re-Christianization of Western culture, because the terms of late modernity, the political, the social, the moral terms, are post-Christian. They're not just non-Christian. That is, they're cultural decisions that have been reached after faith has been rejected, and that's very different from, say, a pre-Christian culture, a pagan culture, which might yet become Christian again. So I don't want to suggest that the decline in Christianity in Western society is just a matter of ebbing and flowing, and that I don't think is the case. I think that if Christianity flourishes again in centuries ahead, it will be in a different form and may emanate from different parts of the world.
It's an argument that Philip Jenkins has made previously on this podcast here, and we'll link back to his podcast as well. One last question on this new atheist movement. You mentioned that it's appeared at this specific moment in time, or you see the Hitchens and the Dawkins and that. Has it had any impact? I mean, you mentioned that the critiques that they make of religion tend to be very shallow compared to scholars in the past, but has it had any impact on the culture at large, or is this just a small blip in terms of literature and historical literature?
No, I don't. I don't think it's made an impact. I think it's the unsurprising manifestation of cultural decisions that have already been reached. I tend to think. I mean, this is going to make me sound a bit like a Marxist, but I tend to think that a lot of these cultural expressions of belief or unbelief are just manifestations of the reality of material culture already in place. And I think the truth is that late modernity, late Western modernity, is already functionally atheist, even if not all late modern persons are personally atheist. I believe that the system of values upon which it is built is one that can't tolerate the rival values of the divine, the transcendent, of the Christian. And so what the new atheists represent is just a sort of vulgar, unreflective, intellectually uninteresting, but momentarily diverting expression of a fait accompli.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's explore your critiques of this new atheism as well as some of the old atheism. So getting into the central sections of the book, the two center sections. And one of the first sections that you go into is you talk about how the new atheist as well as the old atheist envision the age of faith and how they associate it with superstition, lack of progress, and they contrast this to the new age of reason, which we happen to be in now. So let's go ahead and walk through your critique here. Are we in a different era, an age of reason?
I'll warn you before we do this.
Okay.
It's been 5 years since I looked at this book, so
okay.
You might have to walk me through it.
Oh, well, I have it right here at my hands, at the side, though. So, I mean, one of the first critiques that you do in this second section is to talk about how a number of atheists viewed the Dark Ages, so to speak, and they saw, you know, Christendom, you know, dating back 2,000 years or so now, as well as, and more primarily, the early medieval period as Dark Ages. To what extent is that critique relevant? Is it correct? Is it incorrect? And why?
No, I think all good historians of the period know it's nonsense. To be honest, I'm not even saying anything controversial in my book within historical circles. The good historians don't talk that way at all. There was, starting in the late 18th century and revived again in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, this kind of simplistic, childish narrative of rationalist antiquity overthrown by credulous and barbarous Christianity, and this was slowly overcome by, in a sense, almost clandestine forces of rationality that finally broke free in the Renaissance and the Enlightenment. But real historians know that this isn't true. In the western part of the empire, there was a great deal of economic and demographic decline in late antiquity. The sources of wealth and political stability were situated in the Eastern Empire. So there was a decline, a general decline of civilization and civic order in the West in what was called the Dark Ages, a period of barbarian incursion, mostly by migration and settlement, not by invasion, but from what we would consider the early Christian centuries onward. But it was actually the institution of the church and the monasteries that served to preserve from the general ruin, from the general economic decline, the monuments of ancient culture that we have in the West. And in the East, of course, the Byzantine civilization continued on and what ultimately led to the demise in the 15th century, final demise of Byzantine civilization, was simply conquest from a more powerful enemy, the Ottoman Empire. But no good historian of late antiquity or the Middle Ages talks that way about the Age of Darkness.
That is interesting. Let me pause you right here, because one of the persons that you talk about in your book, and you mentioned that much of this thought goes back to the late 18th century. The famous historian Edward Gibbon is one of the main proponents of Christianity leading us into the Dark Ages, and he talks about the sacking of the library in Alexandria as an example of this. It's interesting that you say no serious historian accepts these tropes nowadays or these interpretations of history, and yet I remember... Say what?
No good historian.
And because I was going to say that even going to a Catholic university when I was growing up, you still hear the echoes of Gibbon, that version of history is still taught. I remember learning about the Dark Ages. And so this does resonate. It's still with us, is it not, or no?
Well, it's still with us, mostly at a popular level. And if you're talking about what high school history teachers may have been telling you, yes. Gibbon, take the example of sacking of the library in Alexandria. It's a myth, obviously. The Christians didn't sack the Alexandrian library. There wasn't even the Great Library of Alexandria was probably not in existence at all in the late 4th century, but the supposed sacking of the library at the Serapeum also clearly never happened. And this came about because Gibbon sort of took a single ambiguous line from Orosius, a Christian historian, Spanish Christian historian, which was probably just talking about how in his time, in general, a lot of works had been lost. And I go into the civil history of Alexandria, but it would be, again, several hours of conversation, very complex city. And then somehow extrapolated from that a picture, which he doesn't, Gibbon never described any great sack and burning of the library either. He just says it in a single sentence or two. And just attributes it to the Christians based on this line from Orosius, which probably wasn't about Christians to begin with. That got picked up and turned into the mythology of this Christian mob descending on the library and destroying its book. But anyway, again, those who know the history of the time know that Christians and pagans were found at all levels of society. There were plenty of Christian scientists, Christian scholars. There were plenty of pagan barbarians and brutes and thugs. This is just the way it was, especially in Alexandria. There was no, there were no great orgies of book burning. There was no great Christian resentment against pagan learning. Quite the opposite. Some of the most distinguished scholars and scientists of late antiquity were Christians. And so, I mean, the story really, I'm not saying that there's a matter here of interpretation that has to be worked out or a matter of degrees. It really is straightforwardly just a myth. It's just nonsense. And again, as I say, good historians, I don't mean interested historians, I don't mean Christian historians, good historians of science, good historians of late antiquity, have not been talking in those terms for generations. They really haven't. Only persons who have a very slight acquaintance with the historical sources and a very intimate acquaintance with some axes that need grinding talk that way. Now, that doesn't mean that at the popular level it hasn't remained fixed. Most myths of this sort, I'm afraid, become frozen in place in the popular imagination for generations and generations. I mean, there was a time when school children, I mean, not just men on the street, but school children were still being taught that Columbus was trying to prove that the earth was round when he got his commission from Spain. So
I remember that in grade school growing up. And we're roughly the same age, yeah.
Right. It's the and so what one can do at the popular level, I don't know. What one just has to try to improve education. But honestly, as I say, the sort of given picture of Christianization is one that no one who knows the sources takes it.
Let me fast forward a little bit here now that we're talking about religion and science and the myths that evolve around this, you know, these offhanded remarks or misinterpretations of history. There's one that always seems to come up with the new atheists and with the old atheists, and it definitely infuses popular culture, and that's the issue of Galileo. The Galileo incident, I should say, is usually heralded as, the church is very anti-science. And recently, I think this was a few years ago, maybe 4 or 5 years ago now, the Vatican pardoned Galileo, and everybody says, aha, finally, after several thousand years, the church is back in recognizing the importance of science. But you do a wonderful job of explaining what really went on with Galileo and the church, and
obviously the church hierarchy shouldn't have been involved in this at all. But none of this is news to historians. Let me say that. So I do want to emphasize that much of the historical material in my book is not some sort of novel interpretation or some shocking new proposition. It's just pretty standard fare. You notice, though, that it's always the Galileo incident, the only one that everyone points to.
Mm-hmm.
And that should tell you something.
Yeah, because if this was widespread, there would be numerous incidents that you could list.
It shouldn't have been that easy to... it should be easier, rather, to be able to identify a great number of cases. But we know in the case of Galileo, first of all, that that there was no great Catholic commitment to geocentrism as opposed to heliocentrism. We know about the scientific work that occurred under the umbrella of the Catholic Church. It was also a period of institutional crisis. Gosh, I need to get more sleep. And it's true that the Church was worried about how seriously it was seen as taking the Word of Scripture based on Protestant critiques, but also, the history of how the Bible was read was not particularly literalist, even that late in history. There was no overwhelming sense that any apparent endorsement of geocentrism in the Bible had to be taken literally. What had happened is that Galileo, who was a very difficult personality, came into contact with another very difficult personality, who happened to be the Pope, a man named Maffeo Barberini, later Urban VIII, who actually had been a friend of Galileo's. And Galileo had easily, had earlier rather, been enjoined against teaching heliocentrism as an established truth. I'm afraid the battery on my phone seems to be dying here.
So again, we just had a small interruption here with the phone battery, but we're back with David Bentley Hart talking about his book, Atheist Delusions. And we left off talking about what really happens with Galileo and the Galileo incident. You made clear just a moment ago that it wasn't the issue of heliocentrism that was really causing the problem, but there was something else that was occurring here, a clash of two very strong personalities. Explain that.
Well, as I say, Cardinal at the time, Maffeo Barberini, had actually been a friend of Galileo's, and as Pope had been a patron of Galileo, and this was after Galileo had been more or less openly a proponent of heliocentrism for some time. He had no problem with that. The rules, and it's very hard for us to understand this today, perhaps, for saving the appearances, that is, coming up with a cosmological theory that accorded both with observation and with mathematical plausibility, were that you could propose a model that made sense, as say Tycho Brahe had done, but teaching it as established fact without evidence, if it seemed to conflict with plain experience and authority and tradition and scripture, what wasn't permitted. At least that was the accommodation reached with Galileo. And Galileo had failed to produce any proof, partly because he insisted on believing in circular orbits, and he offered a sort of argument from tidal sequences that the Earth moved, which was nonsense. It wasn't correct. And in fact, he mocked Kepler for suggesting that the moon affected the tide. So that was the situation. But what really led to the final trial of Galileo wasn't some institutional commitment to geocentrism. It was simply that when Barberini, now Pope Urban VIII, had suggested that Galileo write the book that he wrote, that what became the dialogue concerning the two chief world systems, that it be clearly stated that as yet there was no proof, we did not know as a fact how the worlds were disposed. A simple formula, a disclaimer, making it clear that the proof was not there. Well, Galileo included the formula as it was given to him by the Pope, but he put it in the mouth of a comic clown figure named Simplicio. Well, Barberini was, understand, Urban VIII was not a pious man. There's good reason to suspect that he didn't even necessarily believe in God. When Cardinal Richelieu died, his only remark was, if there is no God, he did well, but if there is a God, he'll be in trouble. He was insulted, and he was a man who thought very highly of himself, held himself as a scholar, a poet, he was an aristocrat, and he used his power to get revenge on Galileo by making him recant. Again, from the claim that he had proved his beliefs, he did not make him renounce altogether the notion of heliocentrism.
Yeah, I guess calling the Pope simpleton is probably not the best way to...
You could get away with it today, but yeah. In those days the Pope was the lord of a large estate, so was a prince of secular power as well, and it was, and in this case he was also a man of extraordinary egoism.
Yeah, the it is interesting to note how the Galileo incident still persists today. And when I teach this in my religion and politics class and tell students about the example of how Galileo didn't quite present everything as astutely as he should have in that time period, they still reject this. They just, no, it's amazing how some of these myths do hold. And one of the other myths that seems to hold, and that students are oftentimes very reluctant to accept different interpretations of, is this issue of war and persecution. And this is an issue that comes up with the new atheist, as well as many old atheists, to point out the dangers of religion and how harmful Christianity was for society, is that, you know, all those wars in the past, that they were all religious wars, and think about all the Jews and witches and others that were persecuted. Explain a little bit about what's going on there.
Well, which wars are we talking about here? I've come to the conclusion in recent years that most wars that are called religious wars are not religious wars. You know, they're wars of conquest, principally private wars, sometimes conducted on a national scale. But there were persecutions. There's no doubt about that. The history of the persecutions is much more mixed than people know. The business about witches is nonsensical. However, I mean, there you really are the realm of rumor rather than history. The great age of the witch hunts was the early modern period, not the Middle Ages. There were medieval prosecutions for witchcraft occasionally. The history of Christian dealing with witchcraft, in this case, I mean, with real practices, there were those who practiced what they thought was malign magic. I'm not saying it necessarily worked, but there were, and you could be excommunicated for that, never receive the sacrament. That's true. And then in the late Middle Ages, there were those who believed that witchcraft, that is, a cult of demonic witchcraft, was on the rise. And there were others in the church who denied it altogether. But when it comes to the period of the witch hunts, the early modern period, you'll find that it's secular courts and the secular state that was really most to blame here, that this was a popular mania that wasn't really grounded in any official doctrines of the church, and where, say, the Catholic Church was very strong, where it had, of all things, Inquisitions, because, again, the history of the Inquisition is a mixed bag that people usually are unaware of. Where the Inquisition existed, prosecutions for witchcraft didn't occur because the Inquisition would get more or less dismiss the charges before they ever got to a secular court who would argue against them, because the church's position was that there probably wasn't such a thing as witchcraft. This became the at least in the Iberian Inquisitions and elsewhere. And most of it was popular delusion. So I've heard people talk about the medieval period when 9 million witches were burned by the church. In the medieval period, the actual number of witches burned by the Catholic Church was slightly less than one.
Hmm. Wow, that's not many.
Not really.
No, not at all. How about this?
But as for war and persecution, yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know. As for war, the only arguments of this sort that might come close to holding water. The only that somehow Christianity is uniquely responsible for wars of aggression, which is, again, unconnected to the actual history of Christianity in Europe, would be the early modern period. There are these things called the wars of religion, which we've been taught to think of as wars of sectarian strife. But again, when you go to the histories of these wars, you find something very different. Religious passions were often invoked. They were often exploited. But they were never determinative either of what wars were fought, why, between whom, according to which lines of alliance. the wars that are often called wars of religion were properly defined wars of the emergent nation state. They were all part of the program of early modernity, which sovereign states were breaking free from allegiances and, I mean, the allegiance specifically to the Church and to the Holy Roman Empire, mm-hmm. which were inconvenient and which were rival forms of sovereignty in the age when the nation state was breaking free as and taking shape as an intrinsically sovereign reality.
I think the classic example there we're talking about is the 30 Years' War, which ends in the Peace of Westphalia, which you had mentioned this is around the time that we see the emergence of the modern nation state.
Yeah. And also, let's not forget how much of that war was fought not between princes of different religions, but say between Catholics mm-hmm. fighting one another. Or it's the whole mythology of the wars of religion is probably the most perniciously difficult historical misconception to deal with, because the record is just confused enough, and there's just enough of sectarian passion at the time that even though you can establish historically that religious beliefs did not determine who was whose ally, and that religious beliefs could not possibly provoke the movement of armies against nations, nonetheless, you can make a plausible case that religious passion was sufficiently strong and sufficiently divisive that it could be used as convenient cover, as an excuse, as a language that legitimated violence. So I think you could say that's the closest you can come to making a case there.
Let me use that as a pivot point here in history as we talk about emerging into the or coming into the age of the nation state, which is oftentimes then considered to be the age of the age of reason by a number of atheist critiques of the religion. And you deal with this in your third section of your book, Atheist Delusions. Tell us a little bit about the mythology behind the age of reason and whether it is really reasonable or unreasonable or what have you.
Well, I think the Enlightenment is a good example of one of those historical events that never happened. There was a continuous development from the late Middle Ages into the 18th century of certain philosophical trends away from inherited Christian notions of thought. Believe it or not, I mean, even within scholastic Christianity, arguably, there were strains that would lead to the dissolution of a Christian consensus. But what was the Enlightenment, really? Well, again, it's part of the mythology of the emergent nation state. It comes from a certain exultant awareness of the possibilities of human reason and human discovery, scientific and otherwise, many of which had been opened up by scholastic Christian thought. And early, you know, the rebirth of science, after all, happening as it does in the Middle Ages, not at a later date. It begins the 13th and 14th centuries, arguably. Or at least the birth of modern science, the inductive science that we're familiar with. But it was also a period of deep irrationalism as well. I mean, it's to certain ideas, the Enlightenment, that we can attribute the rise of such things as scientific racialism. I mean, what's the first tract of what's the first really racist tract arguing that there is a deep intrinsic difference between races in regard to moral and intellectual capacity? Well, it's produced by Kant. Mm-hmm. It's a period also in which the forces of reason are uncomfortably allied at times with the forces of modern aggression, modern warfare. But to speak of an age of reason breaking free from an age of faith, again, is one of those things that only bad historians today are likely to do. Because if nothing else, what modern technology gives us is the availability of a lot of texts that were much harder to get hands on, mm-hmm. even as late as the 19th century. And I think more and more in the academic world, in the history department, those who understand the history of modernity are aware that we have to think in terms of continuous development, both good and bad, that there was some sort of threshold we crossed, that enlightenment, or that the 18th century gave us our charter for the sciences, and this required breaking free from the grip of religious fanaticism. Again, it sounds good, it sounds, it makes for a pretty story, it just doesn't correspond with any ensemble of facts.
Let me go ahead and ask about the other aspect of the subtitle of your book, Atheist Delusions. You call the subtitle The Christian Revolution and Its Fashionable Enemies. You bring
That was actually the title of the book originally, The Christian Revolution, and the subtitle was And Its Fashionable Enemies.
Oh, so somebody changed that around there. Was that your publisher or your decision?
No, that was the publishers always can say what they want. They can always make a decision on titles.
Mm.
And again, since the book came out fairly close to the period of the New Atheist appearance on the scene, the title that was chosen was a good marketing choice, I suppose.
So you do listen to your publishers there?
Well, you're not really given a lot of discretion,
okay.
Because if they pay you in advance, they also get to try to sell the book.
Yeah. No, that's true. But let me ask you about that, because that would have been the main title then, The Christian Revolution. And when I first picked up the book and put it in my hand, I said, oh, The Christian Revolution. I am thinking about the contemporary era and how Christianity is, you know, bursting forth throughout the globe. But that's not exactly what you mean here. So explain, in light of what we just talked about here, the Age of Reason and also the Dark Ages before then, what is the Christian Revolution? When does this occur and what is it all about?
Oh, I'm talking about the rise of Christianity in late antiquity,
mm-hmm.
and how profound a difference, whether one approves of every aspect of the change or not, how profound a difference Christianity made socially, culturally, imaginatively. I think it's no exaggeration to say that as a result of the rise of Christianity and how radically incompatible its language, its central narrative was, not necessarily its practices, because Christians didn't necessarily in the early centuries live out the implications of their faith with perfect consistency.
Yeah, we're all sinners.
Yes, and we're all creatures of our time, and so forth. But the very moral concepts that we all share today, or even, and I don't just mean concepts, I mean the imaginative possibilities within which we live and by which we orient ourselves, and that even if we want to reject them, we can, come about not as a result of something inherent in our nature, but as the result, they're to a very large degree cultural contingencies, and they come about as the result of the fact of Christianity in Western history and how radically it changed our vision of reality from that which was there before. When the New Atheists turn to moral matters, some of their morality is repellent to me,
mm-hmm.
but their basic understanding of what the moral good should be, that it's universal in its embrace, that it includes the full dignity of every person, and so on and so forth, is indelibly marked by a cultural history to which they belong, not by some sort of natural destiny, it's not something that we all share in common as a result of having the same basic physical morphology and DNA. And what I really think is often lost sight of, not only by those who are hostile towards Christianity or towards religious belief, but even many believers, is just how strange and uncanny and radical a change occurred with the rise of Christianity and its displacement of the non-Christian or the pre-Christian world.
You talk about it as a liberating message, and what do you mean by that?
Well, it wasn't. I mean, why? People have to ask themselves, why did Christianity spread? Now, you can take the suspicion to its most extreme expression, as with Nietzsche, and construct a very plausible psychology of resentment or, you know, slave revolt and morality. But to an extent, that's a kind of game. Because it's always to some degree true, it's to a greater degree false. You have to look concretely. What did Christianity say that was not being said? What did it propose that had not been heard before? And I think many of us today fail to understand the degree to which ancient culture, and let me state up front, I'm a rapt lover of the ancient world as a classicist. This is not meant as a program, you know. Mm-hmm. Every culture is what it has the resources to be. But the degree to which one's existence was circumscribed by a fairly narrow and confining sense of fate, the degree to which one's social, legal, and personal identity was really a matter of class and ascertainable pedigrees, the degree of hope to which one was entitled in this life and beyond it, the condition of, and I will say the very conditional conditions determining what dignity one could claim for oneself. All of that is from a world that we can't even imagine now.
Mm-hmm.
And with Christianity comes, and again, with the language of Christianity, with the message, not necessarily with the social practices that came about once Christianity had had come to power, because although there were social ameliorations, there were also incredibly intractable injustices in society that the church did not ameliorate.
Mm-hmm.
But with the language of Christianity brought in to the ancient world, this notion of God incarnate as a peasant crucified upon a cross, that in Christ there is neither Jew nor Greek, neither slave nor free, not man and woman, and so on and so forth, really was a radical announcement. It really did require reimagining reality from the ground up. And however poorly it might have been lived out in Christian culture, you know, because all human efforts are defective, nonetheless, what had happened at a very fundamental level was a fully radical shift in how we perceived the nature of reality, the nature of what it is to be human, what it is to be a person, the nature of the moral good. And I've come to believe that that might be the only case in Western history that we can identify of so vast and consequential a revolution in fundamental beliefs in Western culture. Maybe modernity represents something similar, maybe the shift away from Christianity. But as yet, as history stands at the moment, I don't think there's another case of any change quite that large, quite that deep, quite that total.
It would seem that in the modernity period of which you speak, that the echoes of Christianity still remain, and that the specific ideologies that have manifested themselves from modernity, communism, fascism, other forms of totalitarianism, really don't have the lasting power that Christianity has, and so the echoes of Christianity still remain.
Yeah, and this is why Nietzsche really is the only interesting atheist thinker in the modern period, the long modern period from the late 19th century to now, because he understood this. Mm-hmm. And why, he even understood why it was so. When he talks about the death of God, he says it's something that's happened. Western man has killed God. He has rejected God. He's killed God. He's destroyed the highest value. And he has a whole, and in many regards, very plausible explanation of how this happened. But, he says, the news will not reach everyone's ears for many, many centuries. So the question one asks is, these echoes, they linger on, but do they linger on because they've become a permanent part of us? Or is it a dying echo? One of the curious things about the New Atheists is their bizarre optimism. Anyone who confronts the nature of human personality and confronts human history with an unprejudiced mind is not going to be an optimist about the future. You have to be prudent, you have to be realist, you can be hopeful, but to be an optimist is to be a fool. And one of the things I find almost enchantingly stupid about the New Atheism, I mean almost sweetly naive, is the persistence of this Enlightenment progressive myth that that once Christianity has ceased to be a real intellectual adherence for Western humanity, we will continue on with our moral expectations of the universe more or less intact and move towards greater forms of justice and harmony. Richard Dawkins has even said this, if you could do away with all this belief in God, we'd be in paradise.
Mm-hmm.
That is the single most foolish thing he's ever said, obviously. And it's something you can't mock, because in a sense, it's a statement of faith that's almost admirable. I mean, it's blind, it's foolish, but it means that he's not being irresponsible in the way that he could be in attacking Christianity, because he has faith in something, that there is something even better out there. But again, sorry to go on for so long. The question one does have to ask in relation to Western culture is again, those echoes, those seemingly perpetual echoes of Christianity in the language we use, in the way we speak, in the way we imagine reality, what do they mean? Is it because they're also within supposedly highly civilized quarters of our intellectual world, new movements towards a kind of post-humanity, an inhumanity in how we view others, that may be portents of how the future could also go?
Well, that is a future that we are going to have to continually monitor and look at. In our discussion with you, David Bentley Hart, has been a fascinating one today, and we thank you for being on Research on Religion.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.